My guest is Mujtaba Rahman. Mujtaba Rahman is the Managing Director, Europe, of the political risk consultancy, the Eurasia Group. He is also a Senior Visiting Fellow at the London School of Economics, where he teaches political risk to graduate students. He is regularly quoted by the Financial Times, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Economist, and Bloomberg, and has written for the Financial Times, The Guardian, Politico, New Statesman, and may I also Encompass. Welcome back to the podcast, Mitch.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Well, you may remember, listeners may remember this time last year, I invited you on and invited you to look at the year ahead, especially inside the European Union and the United Kingdom. This is just to tell listeners in advance, this is not me expecting you to crystal ball gaze. The basic premise is we're going to look at the year 2026, but we can't cover the whole globe. As I said earlier, let's focus on Europe. But I thought a starting point might be just a quick reflection on the speech that Mark Carney made in Davos this week that everybody is talking about when he talks about this being not a transition but a rupture. To what extent do you agree with his assessment?
I think he's right, Paul, but I think most countries have come to that conclusion early last year on the back of two events. First, Vice President JD Vance coming to the Munich Security Conference and talking about the enemy that Europe has to deal with comes from within, not without. That was a speech that shocked member states to their core. And the humiliation of President Zelensky, Ukraine's president in the Oval Office, by President Trump and JD Vance. I think the combination of those two events led many member states to come to the conclusion that the US is no longer a dependable ally. And I think we saw very meaningful reforms put into effect on the back of those events that made clear the status quo is not something Europe is going to be returning to. Abolition of the debt rate in Germany, a willingness and commitment for European countries across the board to massively increase their defense spending. And Paul, the European Union getting into the business of collective defense, where it has no competence. And we see that reflected in the SAFE framework that will dole out 150 billion in loans to sponsor a collective European defense. So I think the Rubicon moment was last year. Carney is speaking to that in the context of what's now happening with Greenland, which is another shock. But I will say, senior EU officials across all the member states and in Brussels are not surprised. They've come to expect this from the US administration. And so the trajectory is clear. The only question that is in question is the pace. And I think events like Greenland will make that pace of independence from America to the European Union becomes an autonomous security actor more brutal, more quick. And the steepness of that curve, I think, will be accelerated in light of the events that unfolded over the last few weeks.
Well, you use the word Rubicon, and you hear a lot of words like existential and Europe only progresses through crisis. Is this time different? I mean, from the European Union perspective, we hear, as you know, that once the pressure is off, EU member states go back to their kind of more relaxed, settled behavior modes because that kind of that's how they operate. And certainly faced with a major, quote unquote, existential crisis, that things change. Is this one of those sincerely existential moments?
It is, but again, I think the moment really was last year,
Right.
and I think this was just another data point, the Greenland issue. The US trying to grab the territory of an ally because Donald Trump wants to enlarge the presence of the United States on the map. That's what this was about. Let's be completely clear. It was about prestige. It was about ideology. It was about territory. It wasn't security and defense, and it wasn't economics. Those two issues have been surfaced by the Danish government in bilateral consultations with the Americans for over a year, and the administration didn't bite. The reason Trump accepted the deal he did, or the framework agreement earlier this week, is because of two factors: European resolve and market pressure that has effectively forced him to stand down. But I do think this was another example that reinforces the view in Europe that America is not structurally not a reliable ally, because it's not really about Trump, Paul. Trumpism is structural. And so beyond Trump, Trumpism will survive, whether in the form of JD Vance or another spiritual leader that takes up the mantle. And so Europe does need to ultimately do what's necessary to become more independent over the medium to long term. And it's looking to do that. So the vulnerabilities that exist in Ukraine, the vulnerabilities that exist in the context of NATO or on the supply chain side, they are diversifying their relationships. Mercosur trade deals, the commitment to spend on defense and build a collective European defense, and so on and so forth. It's just the pace of change is a function of how menacing the environment seems. And you're right in suggesting when the environment isn't menacing, that pace slows down. When the environment is menacing, the pace picks up. The trajectory is clear, and the trajectory is what over the longer term, where the Europeans are going to be less dependent on American qualities.
Well, I press you a bit because maybe to use a slightly inelegant phrase, the EU does have sort of certain bad habits. When just the time when they're trying to reassert their position in the world, and you say diversify their relationships with other parts of the world beyond the United States, we have this spectacle of the Mercosur deal with these four Latin American countries being put on ice, at least potentially temporarily, anyway, at least by the European Parliament, as if with the best will in the world, the EU doesn't always quite get its act together.
I think that's completely fair. I think Mercosur to me is symptomatic of a bigger problem in Europe that we're going to be confronted by for the foreseeable future, and that is a very weak France with a very weak president managing a fragile minority government that is going to basically limp through the year before it presents the spectacle of a possible Jordan Bardella or Marine Le Pen's win in the French presidential elections in April or May 2027. And that weakness in France is beginning to throw up all kinds of problems for the European Union. We saw it at the December European Council on the attempt by Germany and others to make use of Russia's reserves to finance Ukraine. Macron couldn't agree to the schemes because he couldn't be sure that he would be able to pass through the National Assembly the need for a fiscal guarantee. And now we're seeing it manifest in Mercosur again. And so that is the problem with the union of 27 states that operates largely on the basis of unanimity. Now, maybe, Paul, what could be done here is Ukraine's accession to the EU. That may happen more quickly than many expect. That could be a possible moment, a catalyst to implement broader reform that convert decision-making away from unanimity to qualified majority, that changes the nature of the way the European Council operates, that constrains would-be wreckers in the European Council from doing things that are hugely disruptive to the European consensus that exists on a given issue. Whether that will or won't happen, I think remains to be seen. But I do think your point is fair. And I think your point is important because I think there is a genuine problem now with France's role in Europe, and that I think is going to remain with us for the foreseeable future.
And would it change also big time? Okay, everybody's waiting for the presidential elections in France in April, May next year, with the distinct prospect of a Rassemblement National, a national rally president emerging victorious, right? So things are not going to get any better, even with a new president, that's for sure.
Correct. But I want to go back to something you said about, how Europe performs in crisis versus normal times. I agree with what you've implied, which is, there's always this question, right, Paul? Any given crisis, how is the EU going to perform? And actually, what I think we've seen consistently is in a crisis, Europe performs better than consensus suggests or believe it will. And Greenland is a very good example. This crisis was not about Greenland. It wasn't about Denmark. It was about borders. It was about the UN Charter, territorial integrity, and the
Integrity,
right
right.
to self-determination. And for that reason, member states really coalesced around a very coherent proposition that said, we've got to draw a line in the sand. This is a tipping point. And if Trump continues on this mad highway he's on, where he seeks to acquire sovereign control of Greenland, it will be a moment where we have to respond, leveraging all the tools at our disposal. And so that was an incredibly robust and coherent performance that effectively forced Trump to stand down. You're also right in saying in normal times, things don't work. And I think, Paul, the most obvious example of that is the Draghi agenda. The Draghi agenda is a Bible. Rather than diversify your trading relationship by striking deals with Mercosur and India, you could do a tremendous amount internally within the single market to remove barriers. That would boost growth, create the resources that are necessary that in turn will enable Europe to invest in security and be less dependent on leaders in other parts of the world that may not have Europe's best interest at heart.
Could I interrupt you,
Sure,
Andrade,
sure.
briefly, just by way of context? Because I think a lot of people, this just remind listeners, this is the report produced by Mario Draghi, September of 2024, there would be a request of Ursula von der Leyen, a roadmap or a blueprint, certainly for a competitive Europe. And I think a lot of people, including myself, were surprised at the extent to which the single market is not a huge reality, with, as you're just saying, within the EU member states. And it seems to be slightly unfortunate, to say the least, and I'm being diplomatic when I say that member states, we all like to glory over, say how wonderful the single market is, one of the great achievements of the European Union, and yet somehow it's not exactly a fully functioning entity.
Correct. And then to link this back to your question on Bardella, the likelihood it will become a fully functioning entity if the far right win the presidential election in France is extremely unlikely, because if you look at the Rassemblement National's policy manifesto, they want to do things that are totally incompatible with EU membership. They don't talk about Euro exit anymore because of the experience the UK had with Brexit. That's not a vote-winning proposition, but every element of their platform is incompatible with EU membership, right? They want to unilaterally withhold France's contribution to the EU budget. They believe in national preference, which means they want to subsidize domestic French firms to compete in Europe and upend the level playing field. They don't believe in free movement of labor. They want to control migration. They don't like the European Court of Justice and so on and so forth. And so there's no way Jordan Bardella or Marine Le Pen are going to win power and implement the fiscal consolidation, which is what the markets want, which is what France's public finances need, given the promises they're making to their electoral coalition. And so, there's a very narrow window where leaders need to take the opportunity to advance as much of the Draghi agenda as possible, in particular on capital markets union and in particular on the tech ecosystem. These are the two single biggest contributors that constrain productivity growth in Europe and prevent this catch-up happening with the US and China. And the window to do that is narrow, and like some of these electoral challenges coming down the track, not just in France, Paul, but in 2027, there's Poland, there's Italy. These are big countries that are going to go through very consequential elections that will have big implications at the European level.
One of those 2 points you mentioned, the Capital Markets Union first, now rebranded, as you know, the Savings and Investment Union. It hasn't happened until now. So why would it happen sometime in the not too distant future if it's failed to happen in the past?
It won't, I'm afraid. I think you're right. I think you're right. It's more a plea I'm making to those that will be listening to this to advance that agenda as quickly as possible, because there is a large pool of saving within Europe that could be used and invested within Europe. But that in part, I think, depends on addressing the fragmentation that exists across the various capital markets in different parts of the Union. That's the question of sovereignty, though. Well, it's always challenging. Countries don't want to give up national control over how they regulate that sector, their pension system, their taxation system, their insurance system. Maybe member states recognize the moment and will choose to meet it, and that will be reflected in greater than.
Is there more cause for optimism on the other point you mentioned, which is the sort of what's called loosely the deregulatory agenda, simplification agenda, to give it a more public relations flavor?
Yes.
Do you think is the right focus on that? I noticed, again, quoting, I'll only quote one more Davos speech this week, that of Chancellor Friedrich Merz, who said that there's far too much regulation. I'm simplifying and paraphrasing enormously. There's too much regulation coming out of Brussels. We have to stop that. Do you think that's resonating now more broadly?
Yeah, so I think there's two or three bits of the Draghi agenda that will move forward and continue to move. The simplification agenda is absolutely one, the one that you've just talked about. It's got a really strong backing from Merz and the Chancellery in Germany. They really want to drive that agenda forward. That's sponsored by the EPP, as you know, European People's Party, biggest group in European Parliament. And so there's a very strong political tailwind that that agenda has. And I think businesses like it, and it will move forward. There are other parts of the agenda that are also quite promising. Defence industrial policy cooperation, because of SAFE, because of these commitments to build this pan collective European defence reflected in Kubilius' white paper that was published last year. Even Paul, on a slightly more coherent industrial policy, the idea of buy European clauses to leverage and support domestic firms in their ability to scale. I think that is an area of the Tajani agenda. So a kind of more, it is a more defensive, it is a more protectionist.
Tajani being the European Commissioner responsible for this area.
Correct. And it is a more defensive and protectionist agenda, but it is exactly what the Chinese and the Americans are doing. And so it's good for Europe to no longer be naive and believe in the WTA rules-based system and start doing the things these other large markets are doing to sponsor the performance of domestic firms to compete in the world. And I think the Sejourné agenda on industrial policy absolutely speaks to that. And then, Paul, I do think, the transition to renewables and the climate agenda, of course, at the high level, there is a stronger headwind, but a lot of the very good work done in Rhonda Lane's first term is continuing to manifest now, in particular this transition to renewables that is going to have, I think, that is going to bear down on energy costs. That's going to be important. So it's not like the entire agenda is stuck. Bits of it are moving forward, but the most consequential parts are not. That's the problem.
So the Green Deal is not being sacrificed. The Green Deal has got to be, a shorthand phrase for all the environmentally linked initiatives proposed during Ursula von der Leyen's first term. And a lot of critics saying this deregulatory simplification agenda post Draghi is making too much inroads into the achievements of the Green Deal.
No, I think that's oversimplistic. I think there's a lot of very good work. The first von der Leyen term was about the climate and the digital transition, as you know. The member states received huge numbers of grants from Next Generation EU that could be spent in order to enhance and facilitate the green transition and the digital transition at the national level. And a lot of that money has been well spent. A lot of it has been productive investment. A lot of that will still continue. That scheme will taper in August this year. That money will run out, albeit continue to be implemented over the course of the next year or so. And so I think it's an oversimplification to say the agenda's become completely unstuck. For sure, there are political headwinds, but a lot of the very good work that was done in the first term, where we've seen implementation, will now have some carry through. That is positive. I don't think we can ignore that.
You touched on earlier this notion of the accession of Ukraine to the EU in maybe a slightly modified form of membership, and that would have some impact, no doubt, on other candidate countries. But what kind of impact can you see, without getting ourselves carried away with ourselves too much, for the United Kingdom in terms of some more structured relationship with the EU post-Brexit?
I think, Paul, I think this is a game changer. If it happens, it's going to be a revolution for the EU as we understand it today. What emerges on the other side of Ukraine's accession will be a very different EU. Just to put, and with impl big implications, I think, for the UK, just to put this into context, there's a peace plan. In the peace plan, there are three key elements. One is a US commitment to a backstop as part of a guarantee. A Ukrainian security guarantee. So the first element of that guarantee is the Ukraine army. Second is the coalition of the willing players, this American backstop. Is Trump going to wave a big stick at Putin and do things if Russian soldiers start attacking coalition of the willing soldiers in Ukraine? Given all the officials that I speak to say there's been big movement on that US backstop as a result.
Big movements in what direction? What do you mean by big movements?
Big movement from the US that is now committed to full fat backstops
All right.
as part of that Ukrainian security guarantee. Now, given the US move, Zelensky is signaling a willingness to move as well, and his move will, of course, need to be on territorial concessions in the Donbas, in particular with respect to Donetsk. And that then has an implication for Europe, where the Europeans feel they need to move. And of course, where Europe needs to move is on front-loading Ukraine's EU membership offer. The
Right.
peace plan has 1st of January 2027. I understand every EU leader is nervous about removing that date because they don't want to be seen as the reason they are diluting Europe's commitment to Ukraine. If the Americans have moved and the Ukrainians are moving, Europe can't be the reason a peace deal doesn't come together. And so this has spurred all kinds of thinking in the Commission about what a pre-2030 Ukrainian accession to Europe may look like. And basically, well, what it means is Ukraine would join the EU and it would import the accession process into the Union. So Ukraine would be a full member of Europe, it could sit on the European Council, but it would only have partial access to the single market and the EU budget, and that access would grow as Ukraine implements the acquis communautaire. It just won't do that from the outside. It can
Right.
now be doing it from within. This, of course, has absolutely profound implications for all of the other accession countries. You can't do this in Ukraine and not do it for others in the queue.
Yeah.
And of course, it has implications for third countries because this would be cherry picking, right? Ukraine would have partial access to the single market and the EU budget, which is exactly what Keir Starmer was saying he wants in his New Year intervention at the beginning of the year. So it would have implications for third countries that they would be able to lean into and exploit.
Right. You mentioned a couple of times the EU budget, where you know this famous 7-year cycle, the multi-annual framework, which MFF. We're getting quite close to crunch time now, it seems, by all accounts. How optimistic are you that there'll be a relatively expedient conclusion to this without too much falling out? Because in the past, of course, history shows that these things always go to the wire with a lot of acronymy as part of the discussions.
Yeah, I'm not confident at all. So Antonio Costa's team wants a deal by the end of the year. The reason for the deal won't be surprising. It's because of what we talked about before. It's the French presidential election in April next year. If you don't have a deal before, then it will be completely unstuck by a potential far-right win in that contest. Frankly, even if they strike a deal by the end of the year, I can't see Bardella or Le Pen sticking to it. And so the risk it comes unstuck, I think, remains very real. The challenge, I think, of the deal is going to be net contributors don't want to increase the amount they're paying into the EU budget. Cohesion countries and agricultural countries don't want to dilute the amounts that they receive from the EU budget. So you're going to be in this dynamic, Paul, where national envelopes are really protected. What individual countries get from each of these different policy areas, they will protect fiercely. And the European envelope, which the European envelopes don't belong to anybody, they're European envelopes.
Right.
That's where the pressure to reduce will come from, especially given in the Commission's proposal, it was those European envelopes that have seen the largest increases. It's things like the Competitiveness Fund, it's things like money for security and defense and innovation. It's all the good stuff. That's the problem. The good stuff is the stuff that has a European dimension. That's the stuff that's going to become unstuck because it doesn't belong to any individual country and as a result will be fair game for chops. I think it's going to be really difficult to strike an agreement. I think it's very ambitious to try to do it by the end of the year and we'll see whether they're successful. But the architecture of the EU budget, which is changing to make it more like the next generation EU, right? So countries reform, if they reform, they get access to their funds. That's a very good idea. But whether some of the more ambitious changes the Commission is proposing can get through the European Council when every single country has a veto is a really difficult and challenging political proposition.
Right. Well, we're already at the last question, which you mentioned earlier, the weakness of France in the run-up to the presidential elections next year. What new leadership do you see, or leadership alliances do you see, if any, emerging at the moment? People, unlikely bedfellows maybe, coming together in formations that we hadn't seen hitherto?
So, Paul, I think the weak E3 is a key risk for Eurasia Group this year, right? I don't think Starmer will see the year to conclude, and I think he will face a leadership challenge after the midterm regional elections on the 7th of May. My base case is he will be replaced, most likely by Angela Rayner. I'll be on your show, I'm sure, next year, and we'll see whether that prediction was right or wrong. Macron is a lame duck. Right, there's no other word for him. His problem is he's got too long to stick around before the next presidential election. And Merz, I think, also has big challenges. The coalition is ideologically divided, implementing big bang reforms as he promised in the autumn, not moving forward. And the AfD is the largest opposition party that will do very well in the 5 regional elections, especially in Eastern Germany later this year. So I think we do need to look elsewhere for leadership in Europe. Maybe
Right.
von der Leyen and Costa. Mette Frederiksen, I think, is a real player. He's completely changed Denmark's stance and relationship with the EU, completely undone previously or the two red lines on frugality and commitment to Ukraine and his willingness to spend on security and defense. Meloni, I think, actually, Adam, what I hear is she is a really interesting figure now, and especially with Macron's weakness, she is becoming a leader with a lot more agency and decision-making power, because key decisions on Mercosur, on frozen assets, ultimately hung on which way Italy would break, so she has more leverage. So I think it's people like Tusk, it's people like Mette Frederiksen, it's people like Giorgia Meloni, it's people like Alexander Stubb.
Right.
These are the people I would look to for leadership in Europe. I think Merz and Macron, that's the Franco-German actor, that feels a bit stale for 2026. I don't think that's where the action is going to come from.
Well, as you say, we'll have you back in a year and we'll take stock of your prediction. For the moment, we have to leave it there. Mitch Rahmer, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Paul.